Keris Matthews, and this is the Tell Me the Truth About Life podcast, poems that matter and why. It's launched for National Poetry Day's 25th anniversary. I love to champion poetry because when someone shares a poem with you, it gives you an insight both into the person who shared it with you and the world we live in. A wonderful poet, Wendy Cope, once said, "When a poem doesn't work, the first question to ask yourself is, am I telling the truth?" I don't know about you, but for me, she's definitely onto something there. And in a loud and frantic world, a poem makes space to be heard properly. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Susanna Herbert, and I run the charity responsible for National Poetry Day. This year, we're marking our 25th anniversary with a new anthology and a new podcast, Tell Me the Truth About Life. We ask the public to nominate all the poems that speak truth to them. And today is a special occasion. We've got the poet laureate, Simon Armitage, nominating a poem which speaks truth to him and talking about how poetry and truth are actually intimately connected. Simon was appointed as poet laureate earlier this year. He jokingly says that he now is in the slightly complicated position of supplying the poetic needs of 63 million people. Simon, National Poetry Day's theme is truth. What, as a poet, or indeed as the poet laureate, do you make of truth in poetry?
I think that's a very complicated question that in some ways goes right to the very heart of the art form. Because if I think back to getting involved in poetry in the first place and being attracted to it, it seemed to allow for enormous ambiguity and possibilities that other aspects of the world, you know, particularly news and politics, didn't allow for. It gave everything in shades and shadows and sometimes contradictions. And to my way of thinking, and in my experience of the world, that felt truthful. The world seemed like an incredibly nuanced place. And if I tried to, you know, align my ideas and my attitudes and my sympathies, I couldn't find one place or one thing that represented them. And I've heard people use the phrase sometimes that poetry describes an angle to the universe. And I think that's well said. And that angle is changing all the time. And it's sometimes multiple angles all at once. But that just feels like a truthful representation of what it is to be alive. So yeah, it just seems to me that the poem is a kind of prism for ambiguity. And even though that feels to be sort of dodging the question, in a sense, that's more truthful than anything else I've ever come across.
Do you think there's something about the way in which we expect words to be used in a poem? I mean, I don't know if words are treated the same when they're on a shopping list, when they're in a newspaper. We come to them with certain expectations. Does a poem let you out of that box?
I think it allows for degrees of subtlety and suppleness in language that we don't always want to utilise or we're not always familiar with. So I think on a day-to-day basis, we tend to use language for information or for direct communication. But I think the way to think about poetry is probably the language of language or the language within language. And it becomes very conspicuous and vulnerable on the page or, you know, in the mouth when it's being recited. And we're asked to think longer and harder and deeper about what particular words mean and what reactions they have with other words when they're put in close proximity with them. We tend to grow up being told that, you know, language is a fixed and rigid thing, that every word has a dictionary definition and, you know, can be controlled in its use. And I think what poetry tells us is that language is far more exciting than that. It's far more vibrant. And when language is arranged in a particular way, I think it can lead our thinking to places that we didn't really know about. You know, it can extend the bounds of our ability to imagine.
You had a career before you became a professional poet, and I think I'm right in saying your career was as a probation officer. So you were dealing with people who weren't always necessarily expected to be telling the truth. Is there anything that can be said about that relationship between truth in, I suppose, criminal justice and truth in poetry?
When I worked in the probation service, it wasn't just defendants who were sometimes unfamiliar with the truth.
Yeah.
People on the other side of the dock as well. I mean, the courtroom is a great theatre of language. Truth in that environment was always something that was being sought, but was quite often difficult to grasp. But in a career like that, and in a setting like that, you're often dealing with what are described as facts, you know, hard, cold facts, and you're having to act upon those. And I think there was some kind of contradiction with, you know, my imaginative life at the time. So when I got home in the evenings and at weekends and on bank holidays, I think poetry was sometimes a way of trying to deal with those things or just escape into another realm of language and try and think about things with a slightly different approach. You know, having grown weary each week of language being used for a kind of limitation.
Yeah, there's a kind of binary thing in language in the court where statements are either true or false, and witnesses are asked to say, is it the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, which strikes me as an incredible fanciful demand to put on a human being and on words, because, as you said, words aren't totally fixed. There's quite a lot that depends on the way they're heard and the way they're said in the context.
Yeah, well, and for somebody who is developing artistic theories around the idea that there was no such thing as the truth, I think I was becoming increasingly resistant to, or not very useful to the probation service. We know when we were in court that people have completely different versions of the same incident, and they quite often vehemently believe that they're telling the truth. You have to conclude from that there are as many truths in this world as there are people. That's not to say that you can't arrive at some kind of agreement around a compromise or a negotiated truth, and that might lead us into talking about a particular poem as an example of that, but it was something that I struggled more and more to deal with, and this interview today and this subject of the truth, you know, really made me think long and hard about how I've been able to, I suppose, indulge more recently as a poet in versions of truths rather than thinking of it as something that's cast iron or set in stone.
Yeah, something monumental and fixed like an obelisk. It doesn't really work, does it, in poetry? It doesn't work in language, full stop.
It doesn't.
You talked about a negotiated truth and a kind of back and forward. And I think of poems as places where there is always a conversation going on between the reader or listener and the writer.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I heard the artist Anthony Gormley talking the other night about his work. And at one point he used the phrase to describe the sculptural work of his as physical propositions. And that word proposition, I thought, was really interesting. He wasn't presenting these great big pieces of art as examples of finality, or, you know, even things that were finished and came with a fixed definition. They were reaching out towards the person who would witness them and experience them and engage with them. And I thought, actually, that's a reasonable definition for poetry, at least in the way that I think about it. I think a lot about the material, physical, pictorial properties of a poem and how they are just that. They are propositions, they're offerings or suggestions of some kind laid out there, put forward to be agreed with or disagreed with.
Is there a particular poem that you have in mind when you think about that provisional approach?
Well, I was thinking a lot about Michael Longley's poem Ceasefire. It's become a famous poem because it's attached to, you know, very important moments in history. And the fact that it was first published in a newspaper, it was published first in the Irish Times. So it comes with a kind of documentary veracity anyway. It has the weight of historical importance about it. And it was delivered into a context whereby people weren't necessarily expecting it. And actually, I think that's where poetry works best, you know, delivered to people who might not be reading it all the time and might not be expecting it, and it suddenly appears. So it is quite an astonishing poem, because by the time we get to the end of it, it asks something very challenging of us. Just to give the poem its description, it takes Homer's Iliad and one episode in Homer's Iliad whereby the Greek forces have laid siege to the citadel of Troy for almost a decade, and war has been waging back and forth, and the great Greek warrior Achilles has a friend, a soulmate really, a brother in arms called Patroclus, who is killed by Hector, son of King Priam of Troy. And in revenge, Achilles kills Hector, but worse than that, he won't give the body back. So this is an offense against all the honor and rituals and tradition of death in that period of history, that period of literature. And he drags the body around the citadel at the back of a chariot for several days and continues to mutilate the body. I mean, it's horrific reading, very brutal, very painful. And then there's this astonishing passage in the Iliad when King Priam comes to Achilles' tent and asks for the body to be given back and makes this incredible gesture, which Michael summarizes at the end of this sonnet with this rhyming couplet. He says, "I get down on my knees and do what must be done and kiss Achilles' hand, the killer of my son." So the truths on offer in this poem are just fantastically complex, but also stunningly honest and obvious as well. I mean, in some ways, by using this ancient poem, this metaphor, Michael seems to be distancing the events of Northern Ireland. He's drawing on the sectarian, the paramilitary, the military conflict that's going on in Northern Ireland. It's an obvious parallel, and he's kind of pushing them away because they're too brutal to consider, they're too raw. But in using this poem, a poem that some people would say is the very first poem in the Western tradition, he's saying that this is an eternal truth. It's one that's been true right from the very beginnings, even going back into the semi-mythical history. And this idea that you must kiss the hand of the person who has killed your son just almost seems counterintuitive to any kind of truth. In a Northern Ireland that had been famous for tit-for-tat killings, for every action there was a reaction. The situation was described as the people there were prisoners of history. Nobody could break this cycle. And then I think it was in 1994, the IRA, with a view to peace talks, declared a ceasefire. And that's the title of the poem. And so it gives us this contemporary register. The idea that to break that cycle, somebody must do something so astonishing and so counterintuitive and against almost every instinct, every human instinct, is revelatory. And yet we know this kind of action to be absolutely true. We know it from South Africa. We know it from victim reparation and those schemes where victims of crime have been hooked up with perpetrators. And I guess what I find interesting about this poem is that we just seem to live in such polarized times now. Everybody has a very binary take on political issues. So this idea that the truth might be almost the opposite of what we're prepared to think. It just seems to me to be so crucial. And I can honestly say that, you know, after first reading that poem, it's really changed my outlook. You know, in certain predicaments, in certain situations, I go back to that final couplet and think about that as an example of a response. And probably as well, because it's a couplet and it's lyrical, it has what you would call the ring of truth, which is probably more interesting and more important in a poem than just something we would call truth. It's one of those poems that takes you by surprise, really. I don't think you realise to begin with that it's actually a sonnet. And even though it's broken down into four sections, I suppose the couplet at the end gives it away, but there are rhymes and half rhymes working within it, and it's 14 lines. I suppose that's another device that's been deployed in the poem, because we often think of sonnets as being love poems.
Can you read it for us?
Ceasefire. Put in mind of his own father and moved to tears, Achilles took him by the hand and pushed the old king gently away. But Priam curled up at his feet and wept with him until their sadness filled the building. Taking Hector's corpse into his own hands, Achilles made sure it was washed and, for the old king's sake, laid out in uniform, ready for Priam to carry, wrapped like a present home to Troy at daybreak. When they had eaten together, it pleased them both to stare at each other's beauty as lovers might. Achilles built like a god, Priam good-looking still and full of conversation, who earlier had sighed, "I get down on my knees and do what must be done," and kissed Achilles' hand, the killer of my son.
Michael Longley's Ceasefire. It has the ring of truth, as you said.
It reverberates at the end, that astonishing suggestion, the observation of that particular action, the sentiment coming from that man who is broken with grief and yet can make that gesture. And Achilles, of course, who even at that point is still full of rage and hatred for the man he's killed and for his people, and even threatens to kill Priam when he walks into the tent. So, you know, the emotional stakes are absolutely sky high. But with that one gesture, Achilles, who is ticking time bomb of a warrior, is diffused.
When people talk about poetic justice and poetic truth, they're often talking about stuff that is basically not true, that is made up. You know, Picasso talks about art is a lie that leads you to the truth. And we've had Coleridge talking about the willing suspension of disbelief. Writers of all forms have always wrestled with the idea that it's not direct. It's not something you can underscore and say, right, that is now true forever and ever and ever. Is there something of that provisionality which is unique, do you think, to poetry?
I think it's probably something that poetry has in common with a lot of art forms, which are looking in the end for some explanation of our existence. I mean, I don't mean that to sound too grand, but one inescapable truth to me seems to be that to be alive is a very tangible thing. You know, we do feel very present in the world. It's very apparent to us that we are alive and that we're here. On the other hand, nobody's come up with a reasonable explanation for why that might be. And I think all art is some kind of conversation that goes towards trying to understand that, or at least explain how that feels. Poetry seems to ask questions that go very near to eliciting a truthful response. And that's about, I think, as far as I've got with this art form, that I'm besotted with, and that has become a kind of way of life and a code of belief.
Do you think that poets are more truthful than, let's say, politicians?
Well, I suppose one thing that we tend to think about politicians is that they use language very much to get their own way. And also the language of politics becomes very tired very, very quickly. And then it stops feeling like it has any truthfulness at all because it's just so shallow and threadbare. I mean, if you listen to Prime Minister's Questions or even Question Time and programmes like that, very often when a politician speaks, it's just one cliche stacked on top of another, or, you know, formulations of exhausted language. And you start to feel that it's just a device or some kind of screen being erected in front of you. Very often, politicians are wary that if they start telling or speaking personal truths, that they'll probably start standing outside the party line. And so they just erect these monuments of speech, which are very boring as well.
Yeah, it's right. There's an exhausted language, all those dead metaphors that get trotted out until you wonder if they expect them to be unpacked anymore, if they expect to be read closely.
I know. I can sometimes feel them squirming when they're making these comments, but I recognise that they've got nowhere else to go. Language there just becomes a kind of defence mechanism.
I've seen it in newspapers too. Journalists have the same tendency to reach for pre-packed phrases. And what I find is that a poet often doesn't, or they do a reversal of that. So for the first time, the words come out as if they've been minted again.
Yeah, and I think poets have always felt a responsibility not to use cliché for that very reason. They're emptied of potential. They're exhausted. You invite fresh thinking by finding new formulations, new patterns of language.
What happens when people can't really say the truth because it would be too dangerous? It possibly might lead to major conflict or give great offence. You have to reach for a code. I'm thinking of those times as a child when you have to say, thank you, I really love that present, or something like that. Or of people who can't always say, I love you.
Yeah, I think this probably comes back to the idea of subtlety again, or perhaps irony on occasions. But, you know, language is incredibly nuanced. And I think poets often reach for metaphors as a way of being indirect. I mean, to read a poem that says, I love my mother, for example, just to say that boldly and baldly feels, I think, for the reader a little bit embarrassing. And I think what we want is some kind of sophisticated or elegant way or indirect way of saying it, because in doing it that way, the reader arrives at this implied idea and there is satisfaction in arriving there. We know poetry can be very successful when it is coded, as it had to be, you know, in the Soviet Union, in countries and where there's been political unrest, and where to be direct would have, you know, endangered your own life and the lives of others. I've been with some Chinese poets these last few days. It's a translation workshop, and it's really interesting hearing them dance around the issues of censorship. They've become very practiced at talking about that and writing within a country and under a regime that scrutinizes work and doesn't accept criticism from its people. And yet the poets there are still dealing in a truth, but one which is very slant and very subversive, very coded, sometimes to the point where it's beyond the hearing of the authorities who don't pick up on it.
Finally, Simon, I'm going to ask you about a poem which was nominated for the National Poetry Day 25th Anniversary Anthology. It's a poem called Poem, and it was chosen by Kate Clancy, who is a teacher, and she says she's never, ever found a poem more successful in the classroom because it allows the kids she teaches to think about what they can say, which is true and also interesting and well said. Would you read poem for us now?
I will, Susanna. Poem. Frank O'Hara was open on the desk, but I went straight for the directory. Nick was out, Joey was engaged, Jim was just making coffee, and why didn't I come over? I had Astrid Gilberto singing Bim Bom on my Sony Walkman, and the sun was drying the damp slates on the rooftops. I walked in without ringing, and he still wasn't dressed or shaved when we topped up the coffee with his old man's scotch. It was only 10:30, but what the hell, and took the newspapers into the porch. Talking heads were on the radio. I was just about to mention the football when he said, "Look, will you help me clear her wardrobe out?" I said, "Sure, Jim, anything."
Are you surprised that so many people find that poem a way of unlocking something true?
Well, I'm very flattered. I was just reading that poem from the first edition of the book it was published in. That book is 30 years old this week, and I've noted down some of the review comments, and somebody said in a review that the poems occasionally exhibit a studied gormlessness, and the thing that offends me most about that comment is the studied bit. That, you know, if there's any gormlessness going on, it was absolutely natural. But to think that the poem is doing its work, you know, 3 decades later and with young people, yeah, it's very, very satisfying. I suppose the poem's pretty direct. It's fairly engaging on a surface level, even though it's actually modelled on a Frank O'Hara poem of the same title, a poem that begins, "The eager note on my door said, come round." I don't think you need to know that, really. It's not trying to be a literary poem. And I think it exists exactly in that framework that we've been talking about. It's all the poem is deflection. It's all obfuscatory. It's all kind of matter that's thrown up that doesn't matter till we get to that penultimate line when something of a bereavement is implied. And I was probably trying to write about the way that men or young men often don't deal in direct feelings or find it uncomfortable to talk about feelings directly with other men. I remember being pleased with Talking Heads, not just as a music reference, but the idea that, you know, that could refer to politicians who were talking on the radio in a different register, in a different vocabulary.
I feel that in a way you are the truth teller. It's an odd position to hold, Poet Laureate. It's not really salaried, as I know very well, but it's terribly important because people look to the holder of that role to say things on behalf of all of us who don't quite have the words.
Yeah, it's a peculiar idea that you might be responsible for the poetic needs of 63 million people. but at the end of the day, I'm the same person. I wake up in the morning and try and remember where I've put the car keys, and then just, I suppose, try and sort of lead by virtue of just doing the work as I've always done it. It's been really interesting to think about this notion of truth and how evasive it can be in poetry.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you so much for lending your voice and your thoughts to National Poetry Day's 25th anniversary.
Enjoy the celebrations.
Tell Me the Truth About Life, 100 Poems That Matter, curated by Keris Matthews, is published now with Michael O'Mara Books.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and share it. Or better still, find a poem that speaks truth to you and let me, Keris Matthews, know what it is on Twitter, using hashtag TellMeTheTruthAboutLife.